Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everybody, to celebrate our 300th episode, we're going to go live to the Knitting Factory in Brooklyn on Friday, March 16th. We've got special guests Blake Schwarzenbach from Jawbreaker, Brian Baker, Minor Threat and Bad Religion, and Laura Stevenson. It's going to be a blast. If you want to go, there's links to buy tickets on our website, goingofftrack.com.
Hello, welcome to Going Off Track.
Going Off Track. The podcast where we vary from what you would normally expect.
And then go back to it.
And then stay there for a minute. And then sometimes we go a little bit off track again.
Exactly.
Where are we now? Are we on track?
You know, it's funny. We originally wanted to call this podcast Off Track.
Yeah.
And it was taken.
Off Track.
And I think Going Off Track is a better name, but at the time I didn't really like it that much.
Too long, I thought.
Seemed, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but now it's...
It fits.
It fits. It fits.
You know, if the shoe fits, right?
Yeah, that's what they say. Or in the case of today's guest, if the Doc Martin fits.
If the Doc Martin fits, yeah.
Today we have...
Which it did fit quite well.
We have a very, very stylish guest on the podcast today.
Indeed.
Someone I have been trying to get on the show for a very, very long time. An old friend, Arthur Smilios.
Yes.
Me and Brad were just talking about Arthur's last name because I've known him a long time, but I've never said his last name out loud.
Right.
And I know it, but yeah.
It's funny.
It's funny how you have people like that where you're like... How often do you say people's first names, like, in conversation? Not that much.
You mean last names?
Last names. Yeah. Jeez.
Loopy.
I need a latte or something.
Yeah, probably.
I think maybe I had too much.
Maybe a Girl Scout cookie.
Yes, if you want Girl Scout cookies, hit up Brad.
Yeah, I should, yeah, I do.
You should be using this podcast.
Why didn't I do it? Yeah, goingofftrack.com/cookies. You can buy Girl Scout cookies for my dog.
Is that that's a real link?
I put it up, yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously, if you want to support Brad's kids, goingofftrack.com/cookies.
It supports the Girl Scouts.
Supports the Girl Scouts.
All of them.
Yeah. And Brad's kids. Today on the podcast, yes, you may know Arthur from his newest band, World Be Free. You might know him from Token Entry. You might know him from Civ. Or you may know him as... From the precursor to Civ, Gorilla Biscuits.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the most legendary hardcore bands ever.
Oh, yeah.
And in this podcast, we talked a lot about the making of Start Today, one of probably my favorite hardcore record and probably most people's favorite hardcore record.
It's pretty good.
Yes. So we talked a lot about recording. We talked a lot about... talked about so much stuff on this podcast. Arthur is such a...
Arthur talks quickly, too.
He talks
so
quickly.
And get a lot in.
He's a very good storyteller. And the whole time this podcast happened, I was like, I can't believe we even had Arthur on sooner.
Yeah.
Like, we've talked about it. We've gone back and forth for years. And I'm so glad it worked out. Because, yeah, aside from being like someone who played on all these legendary hardcore records, he also is just a super fun and interesting guy. And...
It's too bad that we couldn't talk more about, you know, like just specific instruments and stuff. Because I'm always curious, like what guitar people play.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to really care about P basses or Fender.
Or what particular model he plays.
There's some gear talk and and we went really long on this one. So if all the gear talk doesn't make the cut to this podcast you're hearing, it will definitely make it into one of our Patreon outtake sections because it's too good not to put out there.
So if you want to hear some serious gear talk, go to patreon.com/goingofftrack and join the team. Join the team, man.
It's true, but
we recorded this today, of course, at Pulse Music.
Pulse Music.
Yes, recorded this at Pulse Music.
Props to them. Thank you, as always.
Yes.
Thank you, Steven Grywalski.
Thank you to the whole team, everyone over at Pulse Music. Thanks to Arthur for taking the time out to do this podcast. And yeah, let's get into this podcast with Arthur from Gorilla Biscuits and Civ.
It's going on track!
So Arthur, I want to start at the beginning.
Okay, let's start.
You are from Long Island.
No.
No.
The Wikipedia page, I don't know who did that. It's completely wrong. None of us is from Long Island.
Okay, hold on. Let's start over so I don't sound like an idiot because we're actually friends.
No, it's fine.
Start over. I'll just edit it.
I mean, Long Island's, you know, technically, I was born on the island of Long Island, but I was born in Queens.
You were born in Queens.
Yeah.
Which is connected to Long
Island. Yeah, geographically, it's part of Long Island, but...
but it's a borough of New York City.
It's, yeah. Geographically, it's Long Island, but... in terms of its soul, it's New York City.
Because I always pictured you as being from Queens, so I thought that was surprising.
I'm Queens.
Okay.
For better or worse.
We just did a podcast with another Queens resident.
Who?
Craig Sitari.
I was going to joke. I'm like, yeah, all Queens people, we know each other. But I do know Craig Sitari. I saw that
you
did that.
Are you from Bayside, Queens?
No, I was born in Jackson Heights.
Okay.
And I grew up between Jackson Heights with my mom. And then my dad is in Astoria, so I grew up between those two neighborhoods. But I was, Jackson Heights is where I'm from. That's where Civ is from, too.
Okay.
Walter is from Rockaway, Queens.
Right.
Luke Abbey is a Brooklyn boy native.
Okay.
And then Alex is Iowa. So, yeah, nobody's from the island.
So how did you sort of get started going to, like, hardcore shows in New York?
So I guess I was like 15 and I was living with my mom, and then just really, really long, arduous story short. My dad was a like alcoholic drug addict, and he got sober, and he waited till he was sober for like a year or two, and he got back in touch with us. He lived in Astoria. So my sister and I ended up moving in with my dad. And at that point I would already started to kind of want to get into different kinds of music. On my own, I guess I call it like entry-level punk. I mean, I had an older cousin who was into it. And so I got exposed to the Dolls, the Pistols, the Clash, Patti Smith, all that through him. And I did actually, I loved the Clash already because like I'd seen them open for The Who in 82. And I had tried to see them the year before when they did the residency at Bond. And my mom, she was great. She was a real like, lefty, you know, progressive, loved New York, person who encouraged us to take advantage of living here. But she drew the line because she bought the propaganda of it being so dangerous. And I suppose in retrospect, you know, Times Square was dangerous then. I freaking loved it. But so she's like, no, you can't do that. I was too young. So I had to see the next year. But anyway, so then I moved to Astoria, and Ernie and Johnny from Token Entry, I had known them from when I was kids, and I used to go and spend the summers at my dad's. And by the time I moved there, they were like full on into it. They had done Gilligan's Revenge. They were like really a part of the whole hardcore scene. So it was just kind of a natural progression that I was into, you know, punk music and new wave. And then I, you know, reconnected with them. They took me to CBGB. And I just, you know, angst-ridden 15, 16-year-old. You go down there, you see Agnostic Front, you see this club completely packed, fire hazard, straight up fire hazard. I mean, and, you know, so I was converted.
And, was that terrifying?
Yeah, completely. And had I not had those guys like Ernie, Johnny, and Anthony Cominali, because by then they were doing Token Entry, take me down, I never would have gone. I would never have had the guts to walk into that club, because the thing about it was, it was a lot of kids like Walter, Civ, and me who were, just working class kids that are about as, you know, frightening as a kitten. But there were some real dangerous dudes down there. Some guys that, you know, in the internet age probably couldn't get away with laying low like they used to do. And, the other thing that I always talk and I bring it up with him was Jimmy Gestapo was from Astoria. So I met him in Astoria. And he's just a really great guy. And even back then, I mean, I'm like this nobody. Because there was a hierarchy and a pecking order in the scene. And, you know, I was, again, nobody, but he, I met him in Astoria, and then the next weekend at Seabees at the matinee, outside the club, he came up to me and was like, hey, Arthur, how you doing? He hugged me, and it was suddenly, it was in these moments where you kind of peripherally saw everybody take note, and I was okay. Like, no, you know, I was with Jimmy. Jimmy knew me. That was okay, because Jimmy was way up in the hierarchy, you know? And so, yeah, that I but it was really a scary place. I mean, even when I knew people, I'd go there and I'd just be like, look at this guy, man. This is like a terrifying dude. And, you know, it was, but I, you know, it was completely addicting. It was like, for somebody like me that, you know, in Queens at the time was really different. It was kind of, it's funny now how Queens is getting gentrified and becoming a cool place, because it was like the butt end of the joke. You know, everybody, you know, I went to high school, like from my high school where Siv and I went to high school, you could look out the window and see Manhattan. That's how close it was. Okay. I went to high school with kids that had never been to Manhattan. And they said, why do you go to the city? Like, what do you mean? Why do I go to the city? It's a train ride away. You haven't been? Nah, I never been. So like the goal for kids that were into different things was to get to Manhattan. And you know, we all did that at some point or other, but, yeah, Queens at the time was kind of, you know, oh, you're from Queens, in this like disparaging way. Brooklyn too. Brooklyn is like the height of cool now. And I
was going to say, like, my wife's family's from the Bronx.
Oh, Bronx.
Her
is
mom
awesome.
And all of, you know, her family and her uncle who moved out of the Bronx, I don't know, 1970 to go to college and never lived there again. when we live in Brooklyn, his daughter moved to Brooklyn. He's like, why would anyone want to move to Brooklyn?
Yeah. Like the old guard still feels that way.
Fucking get it.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad's generation is still like, what?
Yeah.
Why? But it's true. Like it was, you know, Brooklyn was not cool. Brooklyn, you know, the Bronx always had respect for the Bronx. No offense to anybody, but Staten Island is just an afterthought that, you know, we always
Staten Island's Jersey.
Yeah, that's it. We say Jersey could have it. I mean, just look at the way Staten Island votes and Jersey can fucking have it. But, I mean, the only Manhattan was the cool borough. I mean, no, the Bronx, like I said, I've always had like this awe of the Bronx. Well, see, I remember I grew up in the 70s and Bronx was burning and going to Yankee games with my dad and seeing the South Bronx and not really understanding what was going on. Of course, not being a political person, not understanding like these are, you know, this is the disaster of capitalism and this is the, you know, systemic racism and such. I didn't get that. All I knew was like, this is burnt out and this is insane.
I feel like that even lasted into the early 90s.
Yeah.
Like,
hell yeah.
Yankees games in the early 90s was
abandoned
freaky
vehicles.
As fuck. Totally. Yeah. The abandoned vehicles.
No, for sure. It all changed with Giuliani and that broken windows bullshit. But no, you're right. Because even into the 90s, like I always talk, you know, everybody glorifies the 80s. And I was telling a friend of mine recently, a young guy, he's from Colombia and he lives in New York now. And we were just talking and he was asking me all about old New York because he has this romantic view of it. And, you know, saying the 80s, yeah, it was great and whatnot. But I was a teenager in the 80s. Like, my time for a living was the 90s. Like, that's when I was an adult and I came of age and I was out of school and I could do things. And the 90s was, you know, living in the Lower East Side in the 90s. I lived on Rivington Street in this apartment that was, like, with two other people. It was this massive apartment with an outdoor patio in the back. Right on the
Rivington
second floor.
And what?
Between Ludlow and Essex. And I was paying $238 a month.
Wow.
Because it wasn't a legal building.
Right.
You know, that's in the 90s. That's deep into the mid-90s at this point, you know? And so, like, that's really things started changing in the 90s, but it didn't, you know, didn't really manifest and hit, I guess, until the late 90s, early 2000s. But, you know, I hear, like, even the Bronx now is getting gentrified, like the Grand Concourse area.
Oh, yeah.
Bronx is the next spot,
I have friends
man.
Who move there.
It's too far, really? Man.
When I have friends. So
for me, it's close. It's actually funny. I live about a 10 to 15 minute walk from Yankee Stadium.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I live on 142nd between Broadway and Riverside. It's walk up to 155, walk over McCombs.
And if you work
right
uptown there, it's not that far.
Wow. It's a different city.
It is. It's a very different city. I mean, that's the funny thing. You know, my dad tells me stories that, you know, you don't know New York, but then he's like, well, my dad told me I don't know New York. And I guess I'll tell my kids if I have them, you certainly don't know New York.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when back in 1990, I had a second job. I was doing the sound at an off-Broadway show at the Victory Theater before it was renovated. And when I was doing this show, it was around the time that word came out that Disney was going to take over Times Square. And because really into 1990, 1991, Times Square was still Times Square.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I just remember like the pushback with the artistic community being like, no, this is not how to do it. The way to do it is the group with whom I was working was doing it. You do real theater, organic local theater. But I remember I would leave that job at night at like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night after the show. And sometimes I wouldn't take the train from Times Square. I'd walk down to Herald. Or I'd walk up to like 49th Street because it was so goddamn dangerous. I got mugged.
Just being in the subway station. Then
I got mugged at this in the Times Square subway station in broad daylight at 6 p.m. on a September afternoon evening. Shit. I had just picked up a 1962 reissue Fender Jazz Bass. I had put it on layaway. Had worked my ass off, and I had just picked it up. And it was a nice day out, and I had my wallet in my back pocket. I didn't have a jacket on to cover it or anything. And I'm walking down the steps, just happy as I could be, this candy apple red 62 reissue J bass stack knob. And the next thing I know, it was like 10 after 6. Next thing I know, I'm at St. Luke's Roosevelt. It's about quarter after midnight. Oh, and my arm is around my sister and my friends and my sister and my old man were there. And I was walking out, and I'm like, it just, all of a sudden, it was like, what the hell is going on? And so my sister had this relationship. She's like, okay, you were mugged. You had amnesia for the last 6 hours. You're not going to your apartment. We're taking you home. I was just cut up. What had happened was they hit me over the head with, I assume it was like a slapjack or something. And they didn't take the bass, though. That was my first question.
Whoa, really?
Like,
you got the bass?
Too cumbersome to run with it. They wanted my wallet.
Dude, so like, that is a
perfect.
That's
I'm like, they got away with $20. No, they got away with $60.
Take my wallet.
Three 20s and my ATM card, which I could cancel right away.
Yeah.
And my bank card didn't have anything in it because I just paid for the jazz bass anyway. So I was like, where's my bass? She's like, your bass is fine. I'm like, oh, wouldn't that be something? Like, I put this frigging thing on layaway and then, like, you know. But anyway.
I had a guitar stolen one time when I was driving to to pawn it because I was broke.
I've done that too.
Oh, dude.
I don't want to talk about that.
Well, you don't have to pawn anymore with Craigslist.
Yeah, that's true.
That shit, you just sell
this
it.
This was before Craigslist.
Yeah. What'd you lose? What was it?
It was a Les Paul. It was like a Les Paul Deluxe with the thin. How about like that one right there? Matter of fact, maybe that's it. I should check the screen.
What had the P90 in it? The soap bar?
Yeah, no, the thin P. No, the thin humbuckers.
Okay.
It was a nice guitar. But
it's a fucking Gibson Les Paul. It's a nice guitar. They never had a bad year, did they?
No.
That's the thing I learned, because I was a Fender guy, and then once I started learning more, I learned that, like, you know, Fender had some rough years. Gibson never did.
Yeah, it's true.
Although, like, those 70s, 80s Gibsons are, like, 400 pounds.
Yeah, I have an 89 Les Paul Custom, and I think it's, like, giving me permanent back problems.
Yeah.
Walter's Les Paul Custom, the quicksand guitar?
Yeah.
Do you know why he didn't play that for the longest time?
No.
Just the sheer weight.
Yeah.
That's why he was playing SGs.
To stand up and play that?
Have you seen the size of Walter? He's like me.
Yeah.
I remember one time when I was in Token Entry, I was playing guitar, and I played a Stratocaster, and I broke a string during the set. And, you know, it was quick turnover at CB's. I couldn't sit there and, like, restring the guitar. And Gavin Van Vlock gave me his Les Paul for half the set. I really thought that my spine had compressed.
It probably did.
Yeah. I'm like, how do you play this goddamn thing? You know, I'm like,
they sound so good, though.
They do. Yeah. Nothing in the world.
That's why I could never play one because of that. I used to play like a Spirit, which is like a Junior, because it was kind of close to the sound, but could actually wear it for an hour.
Yeah. There really is nothing. There's a reason nothing sounds like a Les Paul. Yeah. I'm just very much, you know, the old guard with that too. I'm like, you want a heavy sound, get yourself a Les Paul and a 50 watt Marshall or a 100 watt Marshall.
Totally.
Get a JCM 800 or a JMP and overdrive the shit out of it with those EL 34s, and you're not going to get a better sound than that.
Yeah, it's true. How did you and Siv kind of like put Gorilla Biscuits together?
Okay, that was it's interesting because I became friends with Walter when we were living. Walter was living in Astoria by this point.
How did you guys meet?
My first job was at this place called Wallbound, a supermarket right down the block from my house. So I got the job. And they were like, okay, Wally's going to train you. Go find him. And I'm like, it's my first fucking day. It's a supermarket. There are a million people here. And they're like, you're going to know. He looks just like you. I'm like weaving the aisles up and down. And I see this freakish skinny kid with the most like adorable Paul McCartney face. And I saw him from the back, and I just remember he was wearing cuff jeans, which, like, if you wore cuff jeans back then, you were either into rockabilly or hardcore. That was, like, a thing.
And
like a
crew cut. Pegging your jeans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's, like, all duck-footed and walking, and I'm like, and I see the crew cut, I'm like, Wally? Turns around, looks at me, just a mouthful of steel. He had, like, braces on both, and, like, silver braces. Hey, man, you must be the new guy. Yeah. What's your name? Arthur. Yeah, man, I'm Walter. Okay, cool. What kind of music are you into? He asked me. I told him. And he actually asked me, he goes, do you ever go to CBGB? I'm like, I go there every weekend. Can I go with you? Sure. So we became friends right away. And interestingly enough, I found out that we one of the things on which we bonded was our goofy names. And he's like, yeah, man, my middle name is Arthur. And I thought he's like kidding with me. His name is Walter Arthur. I'm like, wow, you're like twice cursed. Because I was, but by the same token, I never wanted my middle name to be Walter Moore. But
so that would have been amazing.
I know. So we became really, really good friends, and you know, we started hanging out, and you know, I was in Token Entry at the time, and then Walter wanted to put this band together, and I was playing guitar for Token Entry, but I've always considered myself a bass player. It's the instrument I love. So he's like, I'm going to do this thing. Play bass for me, for sure. And then Ernie from Token Entry was playing drums. So we needed a singer. Now, in the interim, how did we do it? Because Siv was in Jackson Heights. And we met Siv at this point. Now, this is the funny thing. I was in the same high school as Siv, in the same grade as Siv, but we didn't know each other. There were about 1,000 kids in our high school, and there were 4 kids that were into punk rock or hardcore. It was Siv, our friend Danny Zick, our friend Gus, this other kid, I think Andrew was his name, and Siv. But it's funny because Siv and I didn't have any classes together, and Siv is one of the funniest people you'll ever meet. And I was like, dude, we never had any class together. He's like, yeah, because I took all the fucking idiot classes and you took all like the smart guy classes. But it took meeting Walter. Walter met him somehow. And then we all like, you know, totally loved him right away. And we used to take our skateboards from Astoria and skate over to Jackson Heights to the laundromat where Siv worked across the street from his house. And I remember we went to the laundromat and the laundromat had a basement, and it's just kind of like it was a harbinger of our lives because Walter and I were doing everything we could at this point to avoid work. And Siv was like working really hard. And that's like how it's always been. And we'd go to the laundromat after school and Siv would give us coins from the laundry machines to get like soda and snacks from the vending machine. But anyway, they had this basement there and we went downstairs and Siv and his friend Danny, we're still all friends. I saw Danny recently. They had done on the wall of the basement, they had written the lyrics to Last Warning in the exact font that it's written in Victim in Pain. And Walter went and I went down there and it was just like, you know, mushroom clouds from our ears, our minds were blown at how cool this was. So we loved Siv. He started hanging out. And then this is the story of how this is the germ. This is like the incipient Gorilla Biscuits. But Walter would write all these joke songs because he's one of the funniest people. Like, those two guys have done nothing but make me laugh for 30 plus years. And anyway, so we were all hanging out. There was this place called the Pyramids in Astoria that we used to skate. There were these like truncated pyramids outside of the Con Edison plant, and they were perfect for skating. So like all the punk rock kids would hang out there, the hardcore kids.
Those are in a lot of skate videos from that time.
Yeah.
I remember that.
They're in disrepair now. Yeah. I still go back to the neighborhood because I lived there until recently. My sister lives there. My dad lives there. But we were all hanging out, and Only Gonna Die by Bad Religion was on because, you know, it's the 80s. We had boom boxes. And Siv starts singing along. And Siv has, like, really can truly sing. He's one of those people. I'm so envious of him because I can't. So I'm a terrible singer. Like, I can carry a tune for backup, but I wish I could sing. And Ernie from Token Entry was like, you should sing for Walter's band. You should sing for the new band. So, of course, you know, like, the extremely, you know, difficult vetting process. Sure, cool. So that's how that happened. And then, you know, Walter started writing all these songs and a lot of them were really goofy. And then suddenly we kind of realized that we're onto something that Walter... I remember the song that made me realize that Walter really had talent and really could write a song was when he wrote High Hopes. At that moment, I thought, wow, now we're into something new over here. Like, this guy really has an ear for writing a catchy song. So, yeah, and then the original lineup was... And we have the demo, too, that we did in that summer of 86. It was Walter, Siv, Ernie playing drums and myself.
Yeah. What was it like? What was the process like of making Start Today? Because I feel like kind of like to date, that's probably like, if not the most legendary hardcore record ever, like one of them.
Wow. We didn't think so at the time.
Really?
Walter started writing the album. And we got signed to Revelation Records, and Rev had some success at that point, so they had a little bit of money. And we had a budget, so rather than listening to Youth of Today and Judge, who basically told us not to do it, we went to Chungking. We started recording at Chungking. Now, Chungking, what they did great. They had no idea how to work with punk rock and hardcore. And, you know, we got the worst hours. I remember we would record at like 2, 3, 4, 5 in the morning. And I remember it was wintertime, and I lived in Queens and Luke lived in Brooklyn, but the studio's in Manhattan. And we had to be there at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's freezing outside. So I remember Luke and I going and taking a nap at my ex-girlfriend at her dorm. She lived at Weinstein on University Place because she was a freshman at NYU. And we got up and we went and recorded there, and they just treated us like we were trash. It was really kind of funny and annoying. And I remember we had an engineer who had like a really serious coke problem, and one night he didn't have any coke and he was just so freaking irritable. And Walter and I were like goofballs at the time, and we were like making up these songs, these stupid annoying songs.
It's also like you're the client.
I know, we're giving you money. So Walter and I at the time, we recorded Start Today. I recorded it on a 1973 Precision bass that had been stripped down to natural wood, and Walter was recording it on my Stratocaster that I had sold him, my Stratocaster that had also been stripped down to natural wood. So they were both like these ash body Fenders with black pickguards, and they were right next to each other. So of course Walter, having to make a joke of everything in life, is like, wow. I said, he's like, wow, look at that. Our instruments complement each other really, really nicely. So Walter made up this song. And he's like, so the song is Tall and Skinny, because we're both tall and skinny. So he's like, song is, we're tall, skinny, and we have the same guitars. We're tall, skinny, and we have the same guitars. And then he does the harmony, tall, tall, skinny, and we have the same guitars. And then it ends with, at the first verse, it ends, and he goes, well, I'm a little bit short, but I have the same guitar. And it repeats. And at the end of the second verse, he drops out, and I go, he's a little bit short, but he's as skinny as me.
It's a good hook. It's already in my head.
Dude, it'll never leave your head, and you're going to lose your mind and hate me for doing this to you. But the thing is, the night that he didn't have his coke, and he's like, he was actually crawling on the floor, like looking. Oh, yeah. So we're like bored. We're paying for this, and it's freaking 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's freezing outside. So, we start singing the song. He's like, guys, no tall and skinny tonight. No goddamn fucking tall and skinny tonight. So I look at Walter. He looks at me. Because we're tall and skinny. So anyway, we finally realized soon enough like that wasn't happening. So we put an end to that and decided we were going to record it at Fury Studio. And that was the best thing we did, because Don Fury knew us. We had done the demo there. But I remember recording it because we did it on videotape. That was the technology at the time for the least amount of noise. You recorded on
videotape. Wait, when is ADAT?
It's before ADAT. It was done on either, was it on Beta or VHS? I just remember Don had a bank of four.
That's the ADATs. Those were the ADATs.
That's what they were?
Yeah. This was like when? In the early 90s?
89. It looks like
when was it?
89.
Oh, no, it couldn't have been ADATs.
Late 88, early 89.
Don had a bank of ADATs later.
I think this is before. I think it was actual video, like videotape that he used. Yeah. And so Walter's writing the album, and I'm just thinking, wow, this guy is really just progressed. Like, he's hit a new level over here. And, you know, when he came out with the song Start Today, I was like, and then Competition, like, it's like, dude, you're just, and then we were done with the album, I remember. And he's like, I have one more song. We got to learn it and do it. And the song that almost didn't make the album was New Direction.
No way.
Wow. Yeah, it was the last song.
Really?
The last song. Yeah, last song. Uh-huh. And then the interesting thing about that album is that initially the songs they were a lot more melodic. And then, you know, we decided to rough it up a little bit. And I was against it. I'm like, no, no, no. He's like, we're such a soft band. I'm like, yeah, that's what we are. I'm like, we have a singer that can sing. How many sing? I'm like, Richie can sing. Richie Birkenhead can sing, and Siv can sing. We're like the bands in New York that have singers that can sing.
What was melodic? Like, there was a more melodic.
Yeah. Like, okay, so you know the song Cats and Dogs? Yeah, yeah. It's like, man, the original thing, it was a man's best friend is beautiful and affectionate. So you can see I can't sing. An ideal pet, it had an actual, like, up like and down lilting melody. And, I mean, there's some others I can't think of. Like,
because it's funny, I thought even, like, out of bands from that era, your band was so melodic. Like,
yeah.
The hooks and the melodies.
That was the thing. That's what
I'd say. Oh, or like, or competition. So you, okay. So the bass line, I picked up the melody on the bass line to the chorus of that, where it goes, because it originally was memories of better days. And like, they roughed that up a little bit, you know, and, I got outvoted on that, but that's fine because I didn't write the songs. You know, I sat there and I was obstinate about it. I'm like, no. But in the end, it's Walter and Siv. Like, they're the, you know, the guys that are making it happen. And I guess it turned out okay. But it's funny that after all these years, after not hearing the original versions for so long, they're still stuck in my head, those melodies. But I remember we went into Don Fury's studio and we did it in like no time at all. It didn't take long at all. And the atmosphere was just so much better.
Yeah.
I do remember very distinctly when they're still called the Super Bowl Hardcore in January of 89. And that ended up being the picture of me on Star Today is taken from that show. We ran directly over to the Ritz from Webster Hall, the Ritz then. Nothing now. We ran directly over from the studio and Chris Williamson's like screaming at us because we were late. Get the fuck on stage. We're like, yo, dude, just calm down. But I remember as we walked in, people knew we were at the studio in the scene. And that was like, the Super Bowl was like, everybody showed up. So Super it was, Bowl you know, like 1,500 kids. So kids that didn't show up at every CB's matinee were like, oh, yo, you guys, I heard you in the studio. And it just felt kind of cool to know that we had like already generated this buzz that people cared about it. But the thing is, I didn't think people understood, like, you know, I think the 7-inch had a couple of songs that gave an indication. And then the compilations we did, but I didn't think that, you know, I didn't expect Walter to write the things that he wrote. And he still does this to me to this day. And then things that everything he writes. And I kind of like was harassing him recently because a few years ago we were doing the Walter Schreifels project and he wrote some of these really catchy, amazing rock and roll songs and pop songs. And I just looked at him in the last few months. Like every so often I'll bother him about this and just be like, dude, you just need to put those songs down. Let's go in and put these three songs down and just re-release them. Yeah, man. I'm like, you don't have enough on your plate, do you? that's my joke with him now. I'm like, hey, so Walter, you need a new project, don't you? I don't know what I'm doing, Arthur. Why do I keep doing this? But
let's talk a little bit about Don Fury because
yes.
So we've had a lot of bands in here who got their start in that fucking basement, and we've never talked about Don Fury. I've worked with Don Fury, and he is a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And back then...
And a character.
Yeah, and a full-on character.
A total character.
So just describe the studio at the time.
Yes. Okay, so it's on...
Which is on a very prominent
Spring
block.
Street.
Yeah.
It was Spring Street in Little Italy, and he lived in... Did you ever go into his apartment?
Yeah. He used to have the parties.
Storefront. Yeah.
He lived on the first floor, which storefront. Was like a storefront.
Yeah.
And he had the basement, which the studio was in. And, like, I've been there for parties when his neighbors would throw fucking shit off the roof, like water and shit, because people are spilling out onto the street. Yeah. You know, like, but he had kids, too. That was the thing.
He did have kids.
He was divorced, and he had these two kids that were there half the time.
Yeah.
But the studio was, like, you know, sonically and everything, it was horrific. It was just a fucking basement.
It was a basement, yeah.
With a tiny little control room. And he had his outboard. He literally had two of those DBX compressors with the slider on them. And that was all he had for compressors. But dude, he did everybody's records, like Siv, Gorilla Biscuits, Quicksand. He did all the early
shit.
Really
what put him on the map.
Right.
Yeah.
But you see, you go into the studio, you know this. So you're walking down Spring Street. And so anybody walks down any street in New York, you step on them. On the metal doors that are against the sidewalk. Well, to get into Fury Studio, those metal doors opened up and there was a concrete staircase that went down. And I can't count how many times I hit my forehead. Yeah. So you go downstairs, and there it is. You walk right into the control room.
Right.
So the control room was the width of whatever the plot is. You know, how wide is that? 12 feet?
Yeah, at the most, yeah.
And maybe 6 feet deep.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a good 3.5 of those feet are taken up by whatever the board is. So there's like this little couch and like another chair. And then to the right of the board, so that, yeah, and then there's the window. And to the right of the board was the door to go into the actual studio. Studio had a carpet that was probably about as sanitary as the floor of Seabees, because God knows what had been spilled on it.
Never been clean.
Never been clean. And, you know, you just set up your equipment in this one big room. But in the back right corner, he had the fishbowl. That's
where the drums were.
No, I'm laughing because I've got the best story about things that happened in there. And you would play live.
Yeah.
And, you know, you put the headphones on, which to us, mind you, this is my first experience in a studio. I'm thinking this is the most pro thing in the world. And it was comfortable, though. And, you know, you looked at Don and you know, he was in there and you laid down the tracks and then you started with the overdubs. And Walter and Don had this great, great rapport. They kind of knew. I remember when we were recording the Civ album, Set Your Goals, right on the heels of that, Walter was actually simultaneously... He was working on Manic Compression, and it was a beautiful spring day. And I stopped by the studio because we were gonna do the tracks for Don't Gotta Prove It at a 51 reissue custom shop, Butterscotch Blonde Fender Precision Bass, which was a casualty of a pawn shop. That's the one I don't want to talk about. But I was living on Grand Street at the time, and I walked over, and I was like, "Hey, Wally, you're already here." He's like, "Man, I'm always here." He's like, "I'm always here. Don and I are becoming like slee stacks because we never see the sunlight. Our eyes are just getting really big and hypersensitive." And anyway, so just... Okay, they'll go to the fishbowl story. So and both of them involve Sam Siegler. So we're recording one day. So I'm looking over at Walter. Like, you know, I'm listening to Sam, but I'm looking at Walter. And all of a sudden, so the way we're set up is that as I'm facing Walter's, the fishbowl is to my right.
So wait, we should tell you what the fishbowl is.
Yeah, it's the drum. Oh, right. I didn't even explain what
corner,
it is.
In the corner, he had put
the basement.
Like, a plexiglass curved Herf wall.
A half circle.
Yeah. That was like to shield the drums from bleeding into the rest of the room, which just made him sound terrible. But anyway, go ahead.
So I'm watching Walter, and then all of a sudden I notice peripherally a flash of light, and I turn around. Just for a second, the drums stop, and I see Sammy running for cover like this, holding his head for cover. He had hit the light bulb over him, and the drums exploded all over him in the fishbowl.
And the ceiling's only 7 feet, man.
I was losing my shit laughing. Another time, it had gotten so hot in the fishbowl that Sammy just threw up all over the drums. I remember going in there between takes just to see how it was. And I don't know how they survived. It was there was no filtration system. There was no vent. So
the filtration system was between takes. Donnie would open the door. And open the door to the street. And like he would sit. And so that, you know, the Italians would all hear his mixes all day long.
But I just remember, so it's the stale air in there. And then, like, the drummer is doing the most physically exerting thing. So it just stinks in there, too. I don't know if Sam or Luke or anybody didn't just pass out, or Alan Cage didn't pass out in there.
That is so crazy.
Yeah, it's just like...
That should have been.
I wish
a landmark.
I had the chance to go in that there.
Do you know what Siv told me? Actually, he went by, and the restaurant owners are cognizant of what was there.
Oh, really?
And respectful of it, and they actually will let you go down in the basement if you go and say, "Hey, I recorded here." If you get them on the right day or something, they brought Siv down, and it's still pretty much preserved. I mean, they use it as a storage, but
they'd leave the wall up between the control room.
I don't know if that's there, but the things on the walls I think are still there. I think everything's still like pretty much. Yeah, I don't know if the fishbowl's still there, but I got to ask Sid. But he went in about a year or two ago, and he was telling me, he's like, "Yeah, they're really cool." Like they,
wow.
Yeah, I went in, and I was like, I just went in, and I think he just said to me, "Hey, I used to record downstairs," and they were really receptive to it. Like I said, they're aware of what the history of that place is, and you know, just another thing, you know, gone. And it's funny now with recording, because, you know, later on, let's say if we ended up recording at like Bearsville Studios on this massive Neve board that supposedly was the board they used for Quadrophenia. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I want to believe it.
Right.
Because I want to believe that I played bass through the same board that John Entwistle did. Right.
It's true.
It's probably true. It's Bearsville.
But yeah, that studio was incredible. Yeah. I mean, I remember just like, I went into the storeroom of that studio and I was just amazed at like the tubes that they had. And the amplifiers, I mean, the bank of amplifiers I used to record the second Civ album. And then, you know, so afterward, now you look at recording the way it is, digital and whatnot. And then, you know, it's really primitive when you think of what Fury was doing. But for us at the time, it was cutting edge. Like, oh, you're going to do this to cancel out noise? That's brilliant. And it was our first experience drop-ins and overdubs, and punch-ins rather, and overdubs. And
it can be pretty disorienting if you've never done it before.
Yeah, I just thought it was like, magical and cool. Because, yeah, you know, most of the bass lines I got down live, but they're, you know, I'm a human being, and you know, you go slightly off, and I was like, oh my God, we can just do this? And now the way it's done is just so much different.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's like, oh, we can pick that up,
but I feel like,
stretch it out,
compress
it, you know, like,
I feel like especially like for singers, even in the digital age, just hearing themselves in headphones for the first time, like I'll always ask someone, have you sang in headphones before?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it is. Because
it's so, people get super freaked out.
Yeah, and, like, it's disconcerting, I imagine.
Totally lose their ability to sing.
I had a question about, oh sorry, were you still talking?
No.
When Charlie came on the podcast,
he
talked about Civ opening for Kiss at MSG, and he took the subway there.
Yeah, so did I.
You did too? I was going to, that was my question.
Yeah, that's when I was living on, was I living on Rivington at the time? Or was I living, where the hell was I living? I moved so much. During those Civ years, I ended up actually giving up my apartment, and I would just, because we were always on tour, so I would crash with my sister on 81st Street in East End. I don't know where I was staying at the time, but I took, I had my jazz bass in a gig bag, and, I used the P bass. I was using the P bass. And I had a new gig bag and showed up at Madison Square Garden. Like, I'm the support act.
What do you remember about that show?
That they're dicks. I didn't want to do the show.
Really?
I was outvoted 3-1 because we were on the Warp Tour. I mean, in retrospect, I'm glad we did it because it's something to say.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, wait, so we're going to drop off the Warp Tour for 2 days, pay money to fly home, open for Kiss, get no respect, no money. Because at that point, Gene Simmons was saying, even Alice in Chains didn't get paid when they opened on that tour.
Wow.
Yeah, he's like, the payment is the honor of opening for Kiss.
Oh my God.
That's like the most Gene Simmons thing.
I just want to sit down and be like, dude, you do know that you're just a grown man wearing kabuki makeup that's playing mediocre songs. And the only reason people come to see you is because of your show. Because to your credit, you put on an incredible show, but your songs pretty much suck.
Yeah.
You're not a bass player. You're what I call a bass abuser, a bass molester.
Night Bob told me the best Kiss story. You know Night Bob?
No, I don't think
so. The guy, he used to like, Night Bob. He used to do sound at like Don Hills. And he's
then I definitely know him.
And they call him Night Bob because he used to work. He got to start working at the music building on 9th Avenue.
I was there the other day.
There was a day Bob and a night Bob.
No, nice.
But night Bob is like this roadie. He used to roadie for like the Dolls, and then he roadie for Kiss.
Yeah, they came out of the same scene.
Yeah, and he said that, like, besides the fact that he said that Kiss loved the New York Dolls, like they would, whenever they were planning
a tour,
they would talk about, oh, remember when we were there with the Dolls, like how awesome that was?
Yeah, because they owed the Dolls. They took from the Dolls, and the Dolls were actually good.
Yeah. Yeah. He said they were doing this tour that was later, you know, like not, you know, not a reunion tour, but like a tour in like the 80s or late 80s and he said, or maybe early 90s. And he said, you know, they showed up at the stage where the rehearsal was going to be, and they're waiting for Paul and Gene to show up. And he looks up and here come these two guys walking in like gym shorts, like 70s gym shorts. And they sit down and they start talking about the tour, and the whole time they're just like kvetching about, well, if we're going to, okay, Cleveland, we can't stay at that hotel we stayed at last time. That was terrible. And like, they literally couldn't talk anything about the music or the show or the venue. They were just like, literally like just bitching. He said it looked and sounded like I was in the room with two old Jewish ladies.
Was it Paul and Gene?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. Well, I mean, I have mad respect for Ace. I mean, look, I'm definitely like talking shit about Kiss, but it was cool. I mean, one more thing. I do have a cool David Johansen story, and I'll tell you guys in a second. That happened just weeks ago. But one thing that also struck me is that I wanted to get to our dressing room. And so I went to walk down the hall, and security's like, you can't go down here. And I was like, all access, I'm support. They're like, no, that's Kiss's dressing room is down here. It's like, I will walk by it and not look in. They're like, no, you got to walk around. I had to take this massive security route. I was like, okay, what if I tell you that I don't give a shit about them and I don't even like them? Sorry, buddy. It's like, wow. All right. But the best thing is that Civ won that crowd over, and it was not an easy crowd. That is not
really?
Not an open-minded crowd. The night before, apparently, DJ and it had stuff thrown at them, and we're like, so Civ's like, I'm just, fuck it, man. I'm reaching deep inside and getting my queens out. We walked out on stage, holding my 73P bass. We're dressed in this, like, vintage fucking clothing with brothel creepers. I got my hair in a freaking, in a fucking massive quiff. And so we walk out, and there's a spotlight. So I'm like, okay, so if something gets thrown at me, I won't even be able to see it coming to dodge it now.
Yeah.
Walk out on stage, and these are not my words because I don't speak like this. I have to quote it for this is the reception we got. Walk out on stage. First thing, right at me, somebody's throwing, get off the stage, faggot. I look at Civ, and I'm like, this is going to be good. So we get out on stage, and Civ just comes right out. He's like, hey, paraphrasing, whatever. He's like, yeah, we're Civ. We're from New York City. I'm from Queens, New York. We know you're here to see Kiss. We're excited to see him too. We're just going to warm you up for a little while. So people were all of a sudden, you know, okay, well, he's coming out in this way with this humility. And we won them over, and we actually had a really good show, and it was a lot of fun. And like I said, in retrospect, I'm really glad we did it. And, you know, I'm not going to lie and say that I was totally for it. I was against it. But it turned out to be cool, and it's such a cool story to tell. And I could say that I played Madison Square Garden.
How do you sound check for that?
You don't.
You don't. You just show up.
Yeah.
There, you're not allowed to sound check. I mean, not opening for Kiss, you're not allowed to sound check.
Holy shit.
You're like not allowed anything.
You just, you take the subway.
Yeah, you take the subway. Exactly what I did. We all showed up on our own.
Wow.
We all showed up. Civ came up from Thompson Street. That's where he was living on Thompson. Sammy was living on West 11th, I guess, at the time. Charlie was living on Leroy Street, and I was living somewhere. And we all just showed up at our own. I had my 73 P bass in a gig bag. I had left my other P bass on the Warped Tour because we were flying right back. And yeah. But David Joe, I have a great David Johansen story. So I went to see Morrissey last month, and I'm going up to Will Call to get the tickets, and I'm with my fiance, and I look at her, I'm like, David Joe's in the line next to us. She's like, huh? I'm like, David Johansen's in the line next to us. And nobody's saying anything. Nobody's recognizing him, but that's fucking David Johansen, man. She's like, yeah. And I was like, the New Yorker in me says, leave him alone. I don't like bothering people.
Yeah.
So I did.
Right.
So the show ends, and we go afterward. We walk over to where the after party was. And there he is with like two people. And I went up, I'm like, hey, I just want to tell you, you know, you're incredible. Do you mind if I take a picture with you? Yes. So now I'm a little confused. So I had to clarify. I said, wait, so you mind that I take the picture? Yeah. Okay. I just want to tell you, I'm a huge fan. I'm from Queens, and like, yeah, cool. Thanks. Yeah. And my fiance is like this tough little like New York Jewish girl. That's just, I could see her getting irate, and like, just calm down. She's like, how fucking dare he? Nobody else recognized him. And I was like, you want to know something? You know, how dare he, Caitlin? He's David Johansen. He can do whatever he wants. And the funny thing is that in 2012, he had played a show upstairs at Webster Hall. What was that club called? Was it Velvet Rope or something? It was super exclusive. Like, it was one of the most exclusive shows. I think only 50 people got in, and I knew the girl that booked Webster, so she got me in. And I'm watching him play. And so I thought he was going to, like, we had a moment at that show. It was as close as you are. And I made complete eye contact with him while he's singing, I don't know, some doll song, you know, Frankenstein or something. And he's like looking right at me, and I'm just like swooning, hearts and bubbles. So I'm thinking that we have this eternal bond, right? Not so. But I think it's a great story. Like, I got completely cut down by David Johansen.
Yeah.
Could be worse.
Could be worse.
Exactly. But I will say this, had that been Johnny Thunders or Syl Sylvain, we grew up in Jack's same neighborhood, and we went to the same high school. For my first half of my high school, I went to Newtown High School, and that's where Billy Mercia, Syl Sylvain, and And Johnny Thunders all went to school. Yeah. And all grew up in my neighborhood in Jackson Heights.
That's wild.
So I would have pulled that card. I would be like, Jackson Heights, Newtown High School. And I think Sil would have been like totally cool with it.
Yeah.
I think Sil would have been like, yeah, for sure, for sure. But anyway, the Dolls, great band.
I want to mention the first time that we hung out, I don't know if you remember this, was at my apartment in Williamsburg.
Yeah.
And it was like before the 2008 election, and we were watching like the debates or something.
Oh, God.
And we didn't really like know each other very well, because I think I met you through Jamie.
Yeah, through Jamie. Yeah, and I remember this.
And I remembered like...
And it's funny that I remember, because I was like, I'm a raging alcoholic. And I was an active alcoholic then. I'm a bit sober now.
It was like Arthur came really early, and it was like the debates were on, and you were like super animated, and everyone's like... Dude, the guy from Gorilla Biscuits is just watching the debates at your apartment. I was like, yeah, he's like really into it. None of us knew anything about politics. And we were like, tell us about it.
Yeah. And oh God, seems like ages ago.
It seems like so.
Addendum. Another reason. Fuck Gene Simmons is a Republican. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. I mean, have you still, I mean, like, I know you, obviously you're big into activism and that kind of stuff. I mean, is it, have you kind of like, not to like be like a downer for this podcast, but like, have you kept up with all that stuff, or have you kind of like,
I haven't been doing activism lately. You burn out on it.
Yeah.
So I have people that never stop. I have some friends where I just have such respect for them, because especially when you're on the losing side, and I'm a Marxist, I'm a socialist, I'm on the losing side. I'm getting my ass kicked left and right. You know, it's really difficult. And I respect people that keep going with it. I mean, I think it's more important now than ever, because I don't need to say why, we've all been living here for the last year. But yeah, I'm a hyper political person. Joe Strummer did that.
Yeah.
I'll always love The Clash for that. You know, my mom did it too, because my mom was always a super lefty. And throughout my life, I've, you know, moved around. I used to think I was a libertarian, which it makes me laugh, because I think I realize what a scam that philosophy is anyway. But I mean, I can't help but be political. And I think that now more than ever, people need to be engaged and be political, because, you know, I have no illusions about the United States. I know what it is. I know it's always been a plutocracy. I know it's always been a racist country. But we can be better. You know, that's the thing. People are like, why do you hate America? I'm like, I hate manifest America. I'm an internationalist. I hate countries. I think they're false constructs. But anyway, America, you know, what is America? It's what we can be. And, you know, like I said, I have no illusions about what it always has been. But we can be so much better. And it's been completely, whatever good there was has been hijacked. And I was just having this discussion today where it's like, I will gain a little bit of respect for the idea of America if it does stand up and it withholds this assault. Because it's an autocratic assault from this guy. And so far, like, it's holding. It's holding, you know. I mean, we still do have the First Amendment. We still, you know... It's you know, he can't govern by fiat yet. So, you know, that was more than anything. But I'm optimistic, though. It's funny, because Siv has two daughters, and one of them is 15 now. And a few months ago, it was kind of funny, because it was my fiance, she's 27, so I'm not. So I kind of lucked out with this amazing, incredible person. But she was... We were talking about Siv's daughter, and she was, and I was saying, did you realize the next presidential election, she's going to vote? And so Caitlin kind of take a dig at me. She's like, how does that feel that she's old enough to vote? And I stopped. I was like, it feels fantastic. Do you know why? Because I know how she thinks, and I know what her politics are, and I know her whole generation is coming up, and they have that politics. So millions and millions of little Bellas are going to come of age to vote, and all those reactionary, horrible fossils that did this are going to be dead. So I am looking forward to it, because I can't fucking wait until Bella Civarelli and all her friends... Millions and tens of millions of them can vote in the next election. That's going to be fantastic. And, you know, they're not just in New York because of the internet. They're everywhere. That generation, that post-millennial generation, what are they calling them now?
I don't even know.
Generation Z or something,
Well, they're amazing. Because I think the millennials are great. You know, I'm Generation X, and we were better than the one before us. And the millennials... The most maligned generation, like no generation has had to eat more shit than the millennials have, you know? And I love them, and they're great. And then the generation after them is even better. So, you know, I get really discouraged and I get frustrated, and then I just have to sit and think, it's going to be okay. You know, like the great, you know, one of the trillion great quotes about Martin Luther King, you know, the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. And every so often there's a check and we go back a little bit and there's a long way to go. But I really, you know, that's the good thing that, you know, younger people, there are more decent young people. And I don't say decent in that they have to agree with my theories on economics and whatnot. I mean decency, as in not misogynistic, not racist, not, you know, homophobic, transphobic, whatever. Just because that's common decency. That to me, that's an apolitical thing to treat everybody, you know, equally. And that generation is, you know, gives me hope. Gives me a hell of a lot of hope, and we need it. You know. That's the long answer to your question.
No, that's a fantastic answer.
Yeah. Things are, you know, if I live through this, if we all live through this, that next generation's going to be, I mean, that's exciting, man. It's exciting. I can't wait to, because I love Siv's daughter. She's a great kid. That's the funny thing, too. I was talking the other day about, like, wow, you know, here was this kid I used to babysit when she was, like, 4 years old, and now she's, like, this young adult, and she can talk to me about things and has these opinions. She's an actual human being now with, like, that's really smart and really well educated, and just it's, you know, when you see that, it's
what music does she listen to?
She listens to a bunch of stuff. I don't know. It's kind of hard to, you know, 15. They go back.
Yeah, that's true.
But she's really into My Chemical Romance and I guess like what's called now emo. She's funny because I know emo is like, to me, emo was DC 86, 87.
Like Right to Spring.
Right to Spring. Yeah. And Embrace. That was emo. And then all of a sudden the term, I was like, wait, no, that's not emo. No, emo is what happened in DC at that period. Yeah, yeah.
How'd she feel about World Be Free?
Who? Bella?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure she's funny about it because she's not into hardcore. I don't think so. She's come to shows.
Yeah.
She's come to shows, and she's a great kid. She's like, I'm so proud. You know, I'm proud of my dad. And, you know, But yeah, I think that's what she's really into, like emo. But I'm sure she's into a million different things. Because she was really, a couple of years ago, into classic rock, and I was so happy about it. And just really into the Beatles. And I'm like, yeah, that's your base. That's where you start. That's good. And then the good thing is, if that's your base, you go forward and you go back.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like through the Beatles and The Who and Led Zeppelin, I went back to the roots music, to the blues, and got into jazz. And then I got into real deep, deep Mississippi blues, like the, you know, Son House and Charlie Patton. And Booker White and all these guys, and so to me that's a good foundation, the Beatles.
Yeah. Were you guys, to get back to like the early days of the band, it's kind of connected to this. Were you guys like taking lessons and stuff? Like, because I listen to those records and I'm like, it sounds very live and raw, but then it's like some really good playing.
I never took a bass lesson. I took a couple of guitar lessons when I was really young. Walter's completely self-taught. Luke is self-taught. Alex is self-taught. But this is really funny because when we started doing the reunions and I was relearning the songs, I just remember sitting with Walter and I just said, you hooked me up. This is such bass-heavy music. Walter's such a gracious, incredible person. He's like, yeah, you know what, Arthur? Back then, you were the only one in the band that knew how to play. So I was like, fuck, I got to write these songs around the bass. And he meant it, you know, and which is, you know, that's a nice compliment, especially, you know, because the thing is, any kind of a musical compliment coming from him means a lot to me because he's not just one of my dearest friends. I have immense respect for him as a musician. He's actually become an incredible, he was always a good guitar player. He's a better guitar player now than he's ever been.
Yeah.
Like, did you see the last Quicksand?
Yeah.
He's holding it down.
Yeah, for sure.
Or like even in Dead Heavens, he does like most of the leads.
Yeah.
He's a really fine guitar player. He's always had an ear. He knows what to do.
So what was, and maybe we've talked about this before, but so he was involved in writing Set Your Goals.
Yeah.
How did that work exactly? Because I feel this has always been incredibly confusing to someone who wasn't in
Civ. Okay, so the way it happened was we were all doing other things and I was in Handsome at the time.
Really?
Yeah, I was in Handsome.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was because I auditioned.
Did you tour with them?
No.
Okay.
Okay, what happened was they had this bass player, Eddie, and for whatever reason, Eddie's since died, I believe, but for whatever reason, he wasn't in the band for a while. So Petey Hines, I auditioned for the band. And so I was playing bass, and we had this guy from Florida singing. And so I was doing that. Sam was doing a couple of bands at the time. I forgot what else. And Walter had Quicksand. Siv wasn't doing any music at the time. And Walter just had a notion. He's like, you know, let's let's just do this 7-inch. And he wrote two songs. He wrote the song at Tu Brute, and then he wrote Can't Wait One Minute More. And he's like, let's just do this 7-inch. Let's have Siv back in the spotlight. And that's all it was supposed to be, because we all had these other projects. So we went and we recorded those songs, and then our friend Marco Siega, that we knew from Jackson Heights growing up, he wanted to strike out on his own. He had been an assistant producer. He wanted to strike out on his own. So he wanted to create a video resume. So he had this idea for the video, which was what became the talk show. And he basically called in every favor he had, and he got use of Kaufman Astoria Studios for a day. So we had the day, and we invited all of our friends. So everybody that's in the audience is a friend of ours. And, we went through the storyboard of, okay, Armand, you're going to be this character. You're going to be this character. And our idea was get a 60s suit, look mod. And I was like, okay, that's easy as fucking pie for me. I have a vintage 60s suit, of course. I've got the sunglasses. I'm going to jack the bass up like John Entwistle. So we all showed up that day. We did that video. That video made its way to Scott McGee, who was managing Quicksand at the time. Scott McGee started showing it to people at record labels. So suddenly, several record labels were saying, we want this band. Remember, this is like the mid-90s when they were signing everything. Yeah.
They were signing about that.
I mean, it was, I felt at the time like we're pulling the biggest heist.
Yeah.
All these hardcore kids are now post-hardcore kids, and we're all on salary to this label or that label. And that's when the 90s was so fun for me. Paying this pittance for rent on a salary. I'm touring. I'm living the life. I'm waking up at the crack of dusk, going out, drinking for free, getting the best drugs, and But anyway, so then it was a matter of, well, this could be something serious. So Walter started writing the record, and we decided we were actually going to do a band. And then I left Handsome. They got Eddie back. Sam left his band, Charlie, and of course Charlie was a natural choice, because he was living with Walter at the time, and Charlie Outface was done, so he didn't have anything. And it was funny because Siv was really against calling the band Siv.
Really?
Yeah, and he agreed to it only when it was going to be a 7-inch, but then he was stuck with it. Well, of course, he said, how does this make me look? I mean, I look like I'm Bon Jovi or something. Yeah.
That's what was so awesome about it, though.
I know, I thought it was kind of cool.
Because you're like, oh, I know that guy.
Yeah.
From like this hardcore band. Oh, now he's on MTV?
Yeah, that was weird. Like, that was really, really weird, because I remember... MTV actually, there's another band called, were they called Compulsion? They were from Ireland. And they had done a video that was a similar story. And MTV called up Scott McGee and said, you need to get that record out because this video is ready. And we're putting it on hold because we want to break Siv. And I remember the first time it was playing on MTV, and then it got put into the buzz bin in heavy rotation. And I remember the first time we heard ourselves on the radio, we were on the Warped Tour in Atlanta. We were in a cab. It was Charlie, Sam, and me, and we had had a few. And fucking Sammy, we're in the back of the cab, and the song comes on, and Sammy leans over. The poor cab driver is kind of startled. He's like, this is my band, this is us, can you turn it up? And the cab driver's like, yeah, sure, whatever. But that was kind of was never supposed to be. It was never supposed to be a full band. And I remember Walter writing the songs while he was on tour with Quicksand. Shit. Now he would just email them to us. He was on tour with Quicksand, and he would write a song or two a day, and he would put it on a little mini cassette, and he'd mail it to Charlie. Charlie would get it, and he'd be like, okay, here's the next song. And you could hear, I wonder if these recordings still exist. I wonder if Charlie has them or somebody. It's him in the back lounge of the bus playing his guitar without an amplifier and whispering songs in. I think about, how Jane Wiedlin wrote Our Lips Are Sealed. She did it with a tape recorder when she was in London, and she sang it, whispered it, because people were sleeping, and every day, hey, Charlie, hey, I got another tape.
So it's like Choices Made or something, and it's on this little tape?
I'm sure. All those songs, that's how he said it. He wrote them on the Quicksand tour. Yeah, yeah. And then he came back.
That would be awesome to release.
It would be funny. Scenes.
Yeah, brilliant.
But, and then that became... a full album. That was a lot of fun to record. That record was a blast, because that's the time that I mentioned before, where Walter was doing Manic Compression, then finished the Manic Compression sessions, and the Siv Set Your Goals sessions would start. And so he just basically lived in Fury Studio. It's kind of like, I just realizing now, that's kind of been Walter's MO all along. Bite off more than you could chew. Just keep doing things and do so much and leave no time for yourself.
Yeah. But also helps to be really good at writing songs. Like a lot of people, you know, no one could really pull that off.
Do you
off.
Know how many songs this guy's thrown away?
No, I don't.
I don't either. But I do know that there are songs that he's just... Walter does this. This is a Walter thing. I'm rubbing my chin if anybody can't see. So Walter is, yeah, I don't know. I guess it's a good song. I don't know, though. I don't know. And I'm not in any way making fun of him. I'm amazed by him because some of these songs I'm thinking of right now are just such, they're so perfect. They're such perfect, catchy pop tunes. And I love working with him. He's a lot of fun because he gives me a lot of latitude. It's like, yeah, just, and what I love about him too is I trust him so much. If I'm doing something on the bass and he suggests something else, I'll listen to him because that's the other thing. He's an amazing bass player. Not a lot of people know that. Walter is an incredible bass player. He knows music. He knows what every instrument's supposed to do. And, you know, it's that's why it's such a pleasure working with him. He could be, you know, he knows what he wants. And that's the way, and bands work really well that way. I think, you know, I mean, I remember reading an interview with Shane McGowan, and I think in the creative process, he was right. The best bands had like dictators, you know, which is so funny in contrast to what I was saying before about politics. A band should be a democracy in terms of where's the band going, what direction are we doing. But when it comes to songs, everyone needs to subordinate their ego and just whoever writes the better song. Like, I know that if I did a band with Walter and we had 10 songs, probably 10 out of 10 of his songs are going to be better than mine. And I'd be happy with one of mine being as good as anything that he would write. And that's the whole thing. It's like, do you want the band to be the best, or do you want to stroke your ego and then the band shits the bed? So, you know, I marvel at him at anything he does. You know, I mean, Dead Heavens is a great band.
Yeah.
They're really, really good. Anyway, enough of my panegyrics to Walter. I could go on forever.
What about Arthur? What are you doing kind of musically now?
Damn, I'm doing nothing. It's kind of driving me crazy.
Yeah.
I'm practicing.
Yeah.
It's funny too, because
I went to one of your, when you were doing those open mic nights in Astoria, I went once.
Oh God, my God.
It was amazing. I was like, we went up there. I went up there with Jamie and none of these people knew who they're just saying, Walter to some, or Arthur to some guy in the neighborhood. And you're just playing songs acoustic.
Yeah, I should record those songs someday.
Yeah, I thought it was good.
I have about 20 songs I've written. Some of them are pretty good, but I've done them on GarageBand, but my voice is not. It's not a lead singer's voice. I got to find somebody who can sing them because they're cool. They're like very different, and I just wrote a bunch of stuff. But that's one thing I like. But it's funny too because I just realized, you know, you can always be a better musician. And what I'd really love to do, the thing I'd love to do more than anything, is do like a Motown soul thing. So I'm like going now and like just playing along with Jamerson. You go right to the source.
That's some hard shit.
Dude, he did it with one finger. It's mind blowing. Because you play the bass line and you're like, okay, it's not that hard, but what made him think to do this? He's such, I mean, well, you think about the influence of Jamerson, John Paul Jones, Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Paul McCartney was like invented rock bass playing, right? And he's like, it's Jamerson. It's all Jamerson. That's it.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't go very wrong. If you're going to copy one bass player as an electric bassist, you can't go very wrong copying James Jamerson.
Talk about melodic bass playing too. I mean,
well, that's what he did. It was so different. Before Jamerson, everybody was just kind of approximating what the upright did. And they were doing the thirds and the fifths, and that's great. And what I love is that when I write a bass line throughout my life, and I'm not in any way equating myself to Jamerson, but it just kind of felt like this kindred spirit, once I learned about him and how he approached it, that he was the first to incorporate melodies in, just like every so often throw the melody in. And, you know, I mean, you listen to a bass line like, you know where to run to.
Oh,
the bass line in that, and it just repeats, but it's just so freaking brilliant. Or like Uptight Stevie Wonder, that bass line.
Yeah. Sick.
That song is just unbelievable.
Reach Out.
Yeah.
Reach Out. That bass line is...
What was the other one? I listened to an isolated track the other day, and is it I'll Be There?
That's one. Reach Out.
That's it.
That bass line is
insane. My God, I know, right? He said the greatest thing, which is so funny. I read an interview with him from about 1970 or so, and they asked him about his gear. What do you play? Play a 1962 precision bass that I bought in 1962. Okay, cool. What kind of strings do you use? Well, comes out of 1962 precision bass.
Yes.
That's amazing. Yeah.
There's an old story about one of these guys.
I've never seen Brad look so excited, by the way.
He changed his strings and fucked up his bass sound, and he had to go get the old strings back.
Yeah, it was a funk machine.
I think it was one of these Motown guys.
The funk machine, he never cleaned the bass, never cleaned the strings.
Yeah.
The dirt was the tone. Yeah. Well, they were flat wounds.
Yeah.
Why would you ever change flat wounds?
No, you don't have
unless
to.
They absolutely rust.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Yeah. But yeah. Do you know that one of his basses went up for auction last year, but it's not the funk machine. It was his backup bass. He did use it. It has been used by Jamerson, but it wasn't that main 62B right. bass that we
How
always see.
How much did it go for?
They didn't even say, they weren't even putting up a price, I don't think.
Wow.
It was just going to be like, don't insult us.
Yeah,
it's like, I played a 1945 Martin D45 once. I used to work at Manny's Music, and I went to Rudy's Music across the way. I was friends with the guy who, Gordon, worked in the acoustic department. Great guy. And we used to have lunch together, and I went in one day. He still works there. Rudy's moved down to Broome Street, but this is when everything was still on 48th. And he's like, Rudy just got a 1945 D45. And I was like, shut up. He's like, I'm not supposed to show it to anybody, but it'll be cool with you because he likes you. So I went in the back. I strummed an open G chord, and I was like, that's it. I'm not even doing anything after this. What? I'm not even worthy. This tone was incredible. So I asked him, what is he asking for? And Gordon just said, he's like, no, he's not. Anybody who's going to bid on this is not going to insult him. 1945 D45. I'm like, well, he's going to be asking. It's got to be going for at least, this is more than 10 years ago now, too. It's got to be going for at least 70,000 back then. This fucking thing.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Stradivarius.
It's, I mean, 1945 D45.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know, 1954 Strat or a 1951 P bass. I almost bought a 51 P bass. The guy thought it was a 52. And he was, for a 52, he was asking very little. And do you know Davide from Orange 9?
No.
I was with David and they used to have this music instrument show down at, down on Avenue A, and I think around 10th Street back in the 90s, and I went with Dov, and we're just looking around. I'm like, oh wow, 52 P bass, all original, second owner, never had anything but flat one strings, no fretwear.
Like the Telly bass?
Yeah.
Telly style?
Yeah, butterscotch blonde, completely original, everything stock. And I forgot what he was asking, but I was like, that's on the low end. So I look over, I look at the serial number, and I'm like, Dov, come here. He's like, what? I'm like, dude, that's a 51. He's like, yeah, how do you know? I'm like, I know Fender serial numbers. I was like, that's a 51. You do know what that means, right? That's a massive difference. Like, 51 was the first year. Those are the first precision basses. Just that, I mean, the 52 could have been a better instrument if you had two of them, but the 51's going to be worth more because it's a piece of history. And I'm like, I can't do this to the guy. I can't rip him off. I can't fucking, he's like, what are you fucking crazy? I know that guy. He's a piece of shit. And I'm like, I can't do it, man. I can't do it. And I didn't pull the trigger. And I'm actually glad I didn't because I got into some weird times after that, and I probably would have sold it for even less. And I'd rather never owned a 51 P bass than owned one and let it get away.
Yeah,
it's better to never have owned.
Yeah, exactly, because you don't know what you're missing.
All right, that was a fun one.
Whew. I mean, this is one of those podcasts. I looked over, you know, at like 17. I looked over at the clock at 17 minutes. I'm like, fuck, 17 minutes. He said so much already. Like, is he going to be able to keep going?
Yeah.
And yes, he did keep going. And where we ended this podcast was not the end. It actually, there's a lot of gear talk after. There's about 18 minutes of gear talk afterwards.
Here, Tonehead.
You go over to patreon.com/goingofftrack. And you can join the team at any level. There's a few different levels of commitment, but it doesn't take much to get the to check out the outtakes and stuff like that.
Yeah, so. Yeah. If you want to support the podcast and hear those outtakes, you can also hear bonus episodes, get it early. I have never wanted to own a P bass till talking to Arthur, and it's so infectious that now I'm like, I think I need one.
Not only do you need one, but you need a 51.
Yeah,
right?
I need a 51. I know, it's so elusive.
How could you not have one?
Oh my God. Yeah, that would change my life. But yeah, thank you. Thank you to Arthur. Check out his latest band, World Be Free, with Sammy, and also with Scott Vogel from Terror and Slugfest, Despair. So they put out a record a couple years ago. That's great. Members of Judge too, I believe. And one of the members is from a band called Envy, who are a very pretty obscure band from Buffalo. I used to see growing up a lot. Anyways, but yeah, if you want to support the podcast, please donate to our Patreon. If you want to do a one-time thing, you can go to Venmo. I always want to say Vimeo. Go to Venmo.com/offtrack. That'll go straight to Brad. He will probably get it to us. You can also
leave that's where all the beer comes from.
It is,
yeah, because like that, it's easy for me to just transfer that to my own.
That's great. Yeah, I haven't been drinking this month, but I'm gonna make up for it at some point. Also, yeah, can we get organic snacks or something?
Hell yeah, whatever you want.
All right, I like that. You can also leave us a nice review on iTunes. That is always helpful, or you can just tweet at us at Going Off Track and. Like I said, we're working on doing some new social media stuff. So I don't know. Maybe you're sick of social media. I'm pretty sick of social media. I think it's the last thing probably anyone needs. But
this will be uplifting social media.
This will be uplifting
social
media.
Not the other kind.
Yeah.
So maybe we need more of that.
Yeah, we need more uplifting stuff. That's for sure. But yeah, thanks to Arthur. Thanks to Pulse. And yeah, I guess. What else, Brad?
Thank you.
Thank you, the listener. And thank me, Jonah?
Yeah.
For what?
Oh, man, you do so much.
What else am I going to do?
Wouldn't be here without you.
Wouldn't be here without you, Brad. I would be recording that. This on like a digital recorder and it would sound terrible.
It might be enough for some people.
It might be enough for some people, but not for Going Off Track.
No way.
It would not be Going Off Track without you. All right. We will be back next week with another podcast. So see you then.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.